far as the interpretation of those chapters, but we're not there yet.
We have seen in the first four chapters that Isaiah has intermingled his prophecies with judgment and hope. He has brought a very strong case against Judah that God has for their sinfulness, for their hypocrisy, for their empty worship, how they outwardly offer sacrifices, but inwardly they're oppressing the poor, the widows, and the orphans. There's not justice, though there is religiosity, and that is an abomination to God, as Isaiah points out. I pointed out that the people of Judah in Jesus' day were very much in the same condition as the people of Judah in Isaiah's day, which is why Jesus was able to frequently quote Isaiah in passages that make reference to the religious state of the people. He quoted from Isaiah chapter 6. He quoted from other passages which speak of the hypocrisy of the people. Jesus quoted from Isaiah to describe the people of his own day, which means that what we find in the people of Isaiah's day can be found also very much in the first century Jews when Jesus came. Now, in chapter 5, we especially see a connection because in 5, verses 1 through 7, we have a parable of a vineyard. Now, Jesus also told a parable of a vineyard. Now, the parable of the vineyard that Isaiah told, of course, had reference to the people of his own time and their fruitlessness. The parable of the vineyard that Jesus told had reference to the people of his own time. And there's a very obvious connection between the two parables, although they're not identical, simply because they don't refer to people of the exact same period. And God's dealings with the people of Jesus' time were going to be more severe than his dealings with those of Isaiah's time. But we see a connection also between the time of Isaiah and the time of Jesus by the use of this parable about a vineyard. Now, I'd like to read the first 7 verses of chapter 5 and then discuss them. Now will I sing to my well-beloved a song of my beloved touching his vineyard. My well-beloved hath a vineyard in a very fruitful hill. And he fenced it and gathered it out the stones thereof and planted it with choicest vine. And he built a tower in the midst of it and also made a wine press therein. And he looked that it should bring forth grapes. And it brought forth wild grapes. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge, I pray you, betwixt me and my vineyard. What could have been done more to my vineyard that I had not done in it? Wherefore, when I looked that it should bring forth grapes, brought it forth wild grapes. And now go to, I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will take away the hedge thereof, and it shall be eaten up, and break down the wall thereof, and it shall be trodden down. And I will lay it waste. It shall not be pruned, nor digged, but there shall come up briars and thorns. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah his pleasant plant. And he looked for justice, but behold, oppression. For righteousness, but behold, a cry. Now that is the entire parable. You might have noticed there's some similarities between this little parable. It's actually, we might not call it so much a parable as a song, because he says at the beginning, I will sing a song. And it is written in poetic form in the Hebrew, so I suppose Isaiah actually sung this rather than told it. But it has many things in which it resembles the Song of Solomon, which maybe makes it profitable that we've just studied the Song of Solomon before studying Isaiah. Because you'll notice some similarities. First of all, it is a love song. I will sing to my well-beloved a song concerning his vineyard. It also has to do with the vineyard. Remember how frequently in Song of Solomon a vineyard image was used of the female speaking of herself, her body. And the imagery of wine and so forth had to do with the inebriation that her lover felt in having a loving and apparently sexual relationship with her, that the drunkenness or the joy that comes from that relationship was compared to that of wine, and her body was compared to a vineyard. And you can just see that in a number of places as you read through the book of Song of Solomon. Here, Isaiah is talking about God's lover, God's wife, Israel. And he compares her to a vineyard also. And it's a love song about his wife, which is also in the image of a vineyard. Another thing that resembles the Song of Solomon is that there's a change of speaker unannounced. You know, in the Song of Solomon, it's written rather like a drama, where one person will speak, then a different person will start speaking, and it doesn't announce when there's a change of speaker. You pretty much have to tell by analyzing what's being said, who's speaking. here also it's the same way, because in verses 1 and 2, it's Isaiah the prophet singing about God, his well-beloved. And then it's God himself speaking in verses 3 through 7. And so you see there's a change of speaker. We also find the inhabitants of Jerusalem are called upon to witness in verse 3. Just as in the Song of Solomon, the daughters of Jerusalem play a role of witnesses and they carry the story along with the questions they ask and so forth. They play sort of a not very essential role in the drama, but they're there as extra walk-ons, you know, who say something that carries the story along. And so also, as the daughters of Jerusalem play such a role in the Song of Solomon, we see the inhabitants of Jerusalem called upon in verse 3 there. So there are similarities there. As we've just studied Song of Solomon, it may be easier to appreciate the form that this parable takes of a love song about the beloved and his vineyard. Now, he says that this vineyard is Israel. And in saying the house of Israel in verse 7, probably the northern kingdom is not what's in mind. We know that the northern kingdom was called Israel and the southern kingdom Judah. However, there are times when the term Israel still referred to all 12 tribes because they were all descended from the man Israel, Jacob. And you will find sometimes in the prophets where there's clearly a reference to the southern kingdom, but the word Israel is used simply because they are part of the descendants of Israel. This is especially true after the fall of the northern kingdom, where there was no more northern kingdom called Israel. The southern kingdom again was frequently called Israel. But here it may be that both kingdoms are included, because it says in verse 7, "For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah his pleasant plant." So he may be including both the northern and the southern kingdom, the house of Israel and the men of Judah. Or he might simply be referring to Judah as Israel in this case. We know Judah is at least in view because he mentions specifically the men of Judah. Whether Israel refers to them also, it would seem as though it does when you consider the use of parallelism in Hebrew prophecy, or Hebrew poetry, I should say. Then it would seem that the way this verse is laid out, there's a parallel there. The vineyard is the house of Israel. The men of Judah are his pleasant plant. Sounds like something from the Psalms, where one line says the same thing the previous line said, only reverses the order or says it a little different. So I believe that we should see this still as a prophecy mainly about the northern or the southern kingdom, Judah. We're still in that portion of Isaiah where he's dealing with his own nation. And he tells us not only what the vineyard is and what the vine is, but what the fruit is that he looked for. In verse 7, he says he looked for judgment, but that's not the best translation. A newer translation would say justice, which conveys to us more to our minds what the Hebrew really is talking about. He's talking about God was looking for justice. But instead of a justice, he found oppression. He was looking for righteousness, but he didn't find righteousness. Instead of finding and seeing righteousness, he heard people crying out under the pressure of oppression. And so this is what he wanted. He wanted justice and righteousness from his people, and he didn't find it. That is the fruit he looked for. Now, in the parable, he says that he created conditions that were entirely conducive for the production of such fruit. It says in verse 1, "My well-beloved hath a vineyard in a very fruitful hill." Fruitful could mean, of course, literally in the physical sense. Israel was a land flowing with milk and honey when God first gave it to them. It has been somewhat denuded. The forests have been cut down, and God did withhold the latter rain for a period of several hundred years in recent history, so that the area that was once lush is now fairly desert. However, at the time, in David's time and prior, Israel was still quite lush, quite fruitful in the physical sense. In fact, back in Abraham's time, we're told that the area in the southern end of the Dead Sea, where Sodom and Gomorrah was like the garden of the Lord. It was so beautiful. Remember when Lot chose that portion in Genesis chapter 13? It says, "Now that area down by Sodom and Gomorrah was like the garden of the Lord, like the Garden of Eden." It was so beautiful in those days. But now if you go there, it's just naked desert, covered with sulfur pits and salt deposits. So you can see that the land was different then than now. We think of Israel largely as a desert area today, and that's quite accurate. That's how it is. But although it's being cultivated and irrigated, but in those days it was much different.
And so it was a very fruitful environment, a place where there was much prosperity in the agricultural sense. Also, we might understand this figuratively, since he's talking about figurative fruit that he was looking for. He's looking for justice and righteousness. That's not physical fruit, but spiritual fruit he's looking for here. We might say that it was a fruitful hill in the sense that he gave them an ideal situation for producing the kind of fruit, justice and righteousness. The reason that this would be ideal is because he separated them from those nations that had a different standard. He drove out the Canaanites before them. He gave them a new law. He gave them righteous rulers at the first, judges, and even one of their early kings, David, was a very righteous man in general. And so God gave him fruitful, or I should say conducive conditions for producing the kind of spiritual fruit he wanted. Can we get there? He says he fenced it in verse 2, which means that he put up protection around it. This God had done, of course, in protecting Israel from nations round about her. God had promised that as long as the people of Israel were being righteous, he would protect them from aggressive nations outside. And when they were righteous, that's what he did, especially at the beginning. He gave them victories over all their enemies in the days of Joshua, so that they subdued the whole land, and there was no one who moved against them because of the fear of God that was upon them. So he put a fence around it, that is a protection from the outsiders. And he gathered out the stones thereof. Now the stones, of course, this may be just adding to the image of a vineyard. You can't grow vines in soil that's just full of rocks, and you do have to remove the stones of it. There may also be some allusion to this in Jesus' parable about the sower, where some of the seed fell on stony ground, which was incapable of taking root because of the stoniness of the ground. It may be here that he's saying that he removed obstacles to growth of various kinds, whatever they would be, removing the stones from the land, he says, and he planted it with the choicest vine. Now, the choicest vine would be the patriarchs, the original men of God that were who were the root of the Israeli nation. Choicest vine. Now, later, in John chapter 15, Jesus said, "I am the true vine." Implying, and he was undoubtedly referring back to this parable, because it really, the statement has most relevance when it's considered the light of this parable. When Jesus said, "I am the true vine," he's basically saying, Israel did have good roots. God used a choice vine, the patriarchs, godly men, to really begin his nation and to begin his vineyard. But Jesus is the real root of Israel. He's the real fruit bearer in the vineyard, and people only are going to bear fruit if they're attached to him as branches to a vine. At any rate, he's pointing out that he's done everything that should have produced fruit. He's removed every obstacle. He brought in the best vine. It wasn't a diseased vine. There was nothing in the vine itself that should cause it to miscarry fruit or to produce bad fruit. So he built a tower in the midst of it, which means, of course, a watchtower where someone could watch out for, you know, animals running through, little foxes just spoiling the grapes, and wild boars breaking through the hedge to come and eat the vines and stuff. A guard tower. And this probably refers to the city of Jerusalem, which was like a citadel on a hill that was the capital of the vineyard, the capital of Israel at one time, when the nation was joined together. And also he made a wine press therein. Now, no comment made about this. Of course, the person who plants a vineyard would also want a wine press, because the purpose of a vineyard is to produce grapes, to produce wine. Wine was much more commonly drunk than grapes were eaten. The purpose of grapes was to produce wine, because, of course, people didn't drink the water so much in those lands because it wasn't that good, and people would use wine as a normal table beverage. And there was a great demand for great quantities of wine, and that's what vineyards were for. We eat grapes, probably. Christians mostly eat grapes more than they drink wine, probably. But the vineyards were not for grapes, but for wine. And so it's not unusual that there would be a wine press attached to the vineyard or in it, so that once the grapes are harvested, they could be taken directly and juiced, and the process of winemaking could begin. Now, the reference to God having put a wine press in Israel, his vineyard, might have some significance. He mentions it last, after saying that he's given it all these advantages, he might be putting that there as sort of a ominous token that he also has his wine press there. A wine press is sometimes used in the prophets as a symbol of judgment, the wine press of the fierceness of the wrath of God. We see in the book of Revelation that when God sends his angels out to harvest the people of the earth, he uses the image of harvesting the vine of the earth, and they're thrown into the wine press of the wrath of God. And he might be simply saying, after all these things he's done for it, he also made provision for judgment if it doesn't produce fruit, you know. Or he's just saying, there's also a wine press there. Besides all these good things I've done, don't forget there's also a wine press where my wrath can be meted out. Anyway, after he's done all those things, it says in the end of verse 2, and he looked that it should bring forth grapes, and it brought forth wild grapes. Now, wild grapes apparently wouldn't be as good as cultivated grapes, simply because people who were in the wine business and the vineyard business would have crossbred and so forth grapes to produce the sweetest, the best tasting grapes. But grapes that would be growing wild out in the wilderness wouldn't have those qualities. They wouldn't have the same sweetness. They wouldn't have the same desirableness to make wine. It was bad fruit, in other words. He gave them every opportunity to produce good fruit, but they produced bad fruit. Now, these first two verses, the prophet himself is just laying out the scene. Here's what happened. God did this, and for some reason, there wasn't good fruit. Now God himself begins to speak, and to the children of Israel themselves, and the men of Judah, and he says, now you judge this matter. What should I do? What could I do more? I've done everything I know to do to get people to produce good fruit. What do you think I should do? Am I not right to come and overthrow this vineyard because it didn't produce good fruit? He says, and now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge, I pray you, between me and my vineyard. Who is right, me or it? Who has the most valid complaint against the other? Does Israel have a complaint against God, or does God have a valid complaint against Israel? He's given them every opportunity to bear fruit. He gave them the perfect law of Moses, pure law, better than the laws that any of the other nations had around. He drove out the enemy before them. He protected them from invasion. He gave them opportunity to have a truly Christian community, as we might say, where they would have an alternative society among the heathen. But they didn't live as an alternative society. Instead, they adopted the ways of the heathen, and the fruit they produced was not justice, but oppression. They didn't remain righteous and holy before God, but they became intermixed with the ways of the heathen. And so they produced wild grapes instead of good grapes. Of course, that which is wild, as I mentioned, is that which is not cultivated. It's not been disciplined by the hand of a husbandman. It's something that's grown, let its own nature take its course, you see. A vine dresser, as Jesus said his father was, a vine dresser. Jesus said, I'm the vine and my father is the vine dresser. A vine dresser controls the growth of vines. He clips off the branches that don't bear fruit so that the more nourishment can go to the branches that are producing fruit. And he harvests the fruit, and he props up the branches that are falling down, and there's all kinds of things that he does to control the growth and produce what he wants out of it. But a wild vine doesn't have such care given to it. It is something that just follows the course of nature. And so what he's saying essentially is they produced fruit that would appear as though they've been given no care whatsoever. Just like a wild vine out there growing in its nature. Now God had done all the things to it that a vine dresser would do to a vine to make it produce good fruit. But in spite of that, they produced fruit as though he had done nothing for them, as though they had just gone according to their own evil nature. And so he says he has a valid complaint against them. He says, what could I have done more, in verse 4, for my vineyard, that I have not done in it? Wherefore, when I looked that it should bring forth grapes, it brought forth wild grapes. Why is that? And now he doesn't wait for an answer, because there could be no good answer. It's a rhetorical question. He doesn't expect an answer, because what answer could you give? What more could he do? He couldn't do any more than what he'd done. And now he says, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. Go to, I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will take away the hedge thereof, and it shall be eaten up. In other words, the hedge that surrounded it to protect it from invasion of animals that come and eat grapes, he'll remove it. Now these animals that come and eat the grapes, here represent the heathen. The hedge they had put up was a protection of Israel against the heathen round about. It was an invisible hedge, such as the hedge around Job, remember? He had a hedge around Job also. And Satan said, I can't get at him because you've got this hedge around him. And God removed the hedge, and what was the first thing that happened? The heathen came in and stole his cattle. The heathen came and took his camels, and so forth, as well as the wind coming and blowing down his house on his sons and daughters. But the thing is, this hedge that God had put around Job kept Satan from being able to bring in the evil people and evil circumstances against Job. So God had put a hedge around Israel when they were righteous, and the heathen were able to come in and afflict them. But now he says, I'm going to remove the hedge, and he's implying that the heathen will be able to come in. He's going to send the Assyrians in to destroy the northern kingdom. He's going to send the Babylonians in to take away the southern kingdom. And that's what he means when he says, I'm going to take the hedge away. I will take away the heads thereof, and it shall be eaten up, the vineyard shall be, and break down the wall thereof, and it shall be trodden down. That's just poetic. He says the same thing twice in different words. In verse 6, and I will lay it waste, and it shall not be pruned nor digged, that there shall come up briars and thorns. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. So in other words, I'm going to take away all that they had. Now it's interesting. He says, I will command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. Because even though this didn't literally happen, you know, where it didn't rain in Israel at that time, yet after this was fulfilled in a second sense, after the days of Jesus, when Israel was rejected again, and the vineyard was taken over by someone else, the church, then in the land of Israel there literally wasn't rain. And the latter rain was discontinued. And it was a phenomenon that travelers commented on for many centuries. That's why the area became desert. After 70 AD, the rain cycle was interrupted somewhat. I'm not saying it happened right in 70 AD, but somewhere thereafter. And God did not water the land for many, many years, many centuries actually. He says, I will command the clouds that they don't rain upon it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, as we saw. And the men of Judah are his pleasant plant, and he looked for judgment, but he didn't find it. Now, he says, therefore, since I did everything I could to make it produce fruit, I'm giving up on it. They should have been just. I not only gave them the law, I gave them protection from enemies round about. I also sent prophets to them whenever they were straying to bring them back to the ways of justice, to tell them to do righteously, to not take bribes, to tell them to judge in favor of the cause of the righteous and to uphold the cause of the poor and the widows and the orphans. They never did. I gave them all these advantages and they rejected them. Therefore, he says, what I'm going to do, I'm just going to break down the hedge and that's going to be the end of the vineyard. So it would appear. Now, elsewhere, there's reference to there being a bit of a branch left over, a bit of a remnant left over, which he would use again. But it seems clear that the promise here is basically just a threat of destruction without a look forward at anything better. Now, I want to look over at Jesus' parable because of its similarity and its difference with respect to this parable. I don't think anyone could doubt in Matthew 21 that Jesus was thinking of this parable in Isaiah when he spoke this parable in Matthew 21. This is just before his crucifixion. It's at the end of his ministry. He was taken and crucified within a few days of this statement. We can begin reading at verse 33. Jesus said, hear another parable. There was a certain householder which planted a vineyard and hedged it round about and digged a winepress in it and built a tower and let it out to husbandmen and went into a far country. Sounds similar? You got the hedge, you got the tower, you got the winepress, you've got the vineyard that's planted by a certain owner. That is obviously God. And it obviously has parallel to what we read in Isaiah chapter 5. A difference here though, a different focus that Jesus brings up that Isaiah didn't mention, is that the owner left it in the care of certain persons. He said he let it out to husbandmen. This meant there were certain people who had skills, or were supposed to have skills, as vine attendants, vine dressers, and he let it out to them. That means he leased the property to them. He gave them the stewardship over the vineyard. He went to a far country himself, which means that he wasn't superintending it quite as directly as these other people were. These other people were supposed to be taking care of it for him. They didn't own it. He didn't sell it to them. He let it out to them, which means that they would use the vineyard to produce fruit, and then he would expect a certain fruit to be given to him at the end of the harvest season. And so they would keep their share for their labors, and then they would give him what he had coming. That's the arrangement. We have a reference to that also in Song of Solomon, how that a vineyard would be leased out to tenants on that basis. It's in Song of Solomon, chapter 8, verse 11. So Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Haman, and he let out the vineyard unto keepers. Every one for the fruit thereof was to bring 1,000 pieces of silver. In other words, Solomon put keepers in charge of his vineyard, and they were supposed to bring to him 1,000 pieces of silver, which means probably yearly they would sell the crop, and of the fruit, 1,000 pieces of silver worth would be given to him. Okay, so this is the same kind of arrangement apparently common in Israeli society from the days of Solomon, at least, and probably before, even up to the time of Jesus. He's saying this is what this householder did. He let his vineyard out to husbandmen. Now this focuses on the persons who were the keepers of Israel. Now it's obvious who the keepers of Israel were. They were the leaders, the religious leaders. The ones that Ezekiel spoke of as the shepherds, and Jeremiah spoke of them as the shepherds also, because they were actually given charge of the sheep, or of the vineyard, if you change the image. This refers to the Sanhedrin, the priesthood, the scribes and Pharisees. Those were providing spiritual leadership for Israel. Now, we can assume that God was looking for the same fruit in this parable as he was looking for in the parable of Isaiah. In Isaiah's day, God was looking for the fruit of justice and righteousness, remember? Now, there's every reason to believe that the fruit of this parable that God's looking for is the same thing. Therefore, the leaders of Israel were charged by God to produce in the people these characteristics, justice and righteousness. But as we know, the leaders of the Jews did not produce justice and righteousness either in the people or in themselves. They were unjust and unrighteous, as Jesus and John the Baptist both exposed very plainly. So you can see how this parable is going. He's talking about how there's this vineyard again, very similar to the story in Isaiah. It's very clear that the vineyard is Israel, but as we'll find out from Jesus' summary statement in verse 43, it's not Israel the nation so much as the spiritual Israel, the kingdom of God. We'll see that in a moment. All right? And then it says in verse 34, "And when the time of the fruit drew near, he sent his servants to the husbandmen," meaning the tenants, "that they might receive the fruits of it." That is, he sent messengers to pick up his share of the fruit to take back to him. "And the husbandman took his servants and beat one and killed another and stoned another." This is a picture of how the prophets were treated. When Israel in the Old Testament times was not producing justice and righteousness, what did God do? He sent his servants to collect the fruit. He sent the prophets to say, "Hey, bring forth justice. Hey, bring forth righteousness. Turn from your wicked ways. Return to the law of Moses. Do righteousness," and so forth. Judge rightly. This is the servants are the prophets of the Old Testament. God would send his servants to the rulers of the vineyard to say, "Hey, where's the fruit?" And the prophets were treated in this way. They were beaten. Almost all of them were killed by their own countrymen, and stoned, and so forth. And so Jesus is basically summarizing the whole prophetic period in verse 35. The husbandmen, the keepers, the kings in those days, and the rulers, the priesthood of Israel, killed the prophets. And then verse 36, "And again he sent other servants, more than the first, and they did unto them likewise." In other words, as time went on and the first prophets were killed and rejected, he sent more. He increased the prophetic activity, especially near the end of Israel's history. He sent more and more prophets just to give them a stronger warning. But they treated them likewise. The parable is saying essentially that throughout their history, they always rejected their prophets. And then it says in verse 37, "And last of all, he sent unto them his son, saying, they will reverence my son." Well, there's no question what this refers to. He's saying that the last messenger that God sent Israel was his son, Jesus. Now, since these other messengers were all the prophets, and he says his son was last of all, does that mean there are no more prophets since Jesus? Well, that can't be the case, because in the book of Acts, we find prophets like Agabus and Silas and others who are specifically called prophets. It says in Acts chapter 13, there were certain prophets and teachers in the church in Jerusalem, and in a number of places in the epistles, and particularly in Ephesians 4:11 and in 1 Corinthians, we find reference to prophets in the church. So it's clear that Jesus was not the last person to come as a prophet from the Lord. So why does he say last of all? The answer is because Jesus was the last of the prophets to be sent to Israel. This is what he's saying. God was giving Israel, the nation, one last chance. This would be his final word to them. Now, there have been prophets since, but they have not been prophets to Israel. They've been prophets in the church. Prophets to the church. That's a different entity. So what he's saying here, he's speaking to people of his day. He's saying, God has given you so many chances. He sent his prophets, and you've rejected and killed every one. But now he's giving you one last chance. Don't blow this one. He sent his son. I'm him, he's saying. I'm here as your last opportunity. And what are you going to do to him? He says, sir, the owner says, certainly they'll reverence my son. But verse 38, but when the husbandmen saw the son, they said among themselves, this is the heir. Come, let us kill him, and let us seize on his inheritance. Now, it's very clear that they wanted the vineyard for themselves. They didn't own it. They had no right to it. They were just renters. They were just leasing it. But they figured, now, here's the only son of the owner. If we get rid of him, eventually the owner's going to die, and then who's going to inherit the vineyard but us? Obviously, we'll be the natural ones to take it over. So they're basically saying, let's take it from the owner and his son and keep it for ourselves. And he's essentially saying that the rulers of the Jews in his day, we're talking about Jesus' day now, the scribes, the Pharisees, Sanhedrin, the priesthood, these rulers were not thinking of Israel as God's possession. Or if they were, they were trying to wrest it from his hands. They were not using it. They were not using a position of rulership to bring about God's desired ends for him, seeing him as the owner and them as the tenants or the stewards. They were seeing themselves as trying to secure for themselves a permanent position of power, so that regardless of whatever the owner wanted, they would end up with security, job security. They would be rulers there. They would own it, essentially. And they could do whatever they wanted to with it instead of what God wanted with it. And so, basically, it's interesting because he says, they saw the son and they recognized him as the heir. It's not as though they said, who are you? I don't believe you're the son, and therefore killed him. They knew he was the son, and their reason for killing him was that they wanted to take, they wanted to hold on to their position and not give it up to him. You see, the Jews of Jesus' time knew he was the Messiah. Now, I'm not saying they knew it consciously. It's very easy to repress information that you don't want to believe. But they subconsciously sensed that this must be the Son. I mean, how could they deny it? They saw instances of him raising the dead and casting out demons and helping the poor and doing the works that the Messiah would do. They must have known intuitively that this must be the Messiah. And the fact that he claimed to be added to it. But then, there was something in it that said, we can't let this be the Messiah because he'll take our position. Messiah is going to rule. And this guy's not on our side. If he comes to the power, we're going to lose our jobs. He'll probably replace us with his disciples. That's no doubt the way they were thinking, at least subconsciously. And so they said, this is the heir. He's come to take over the place. Let's get him out of the way so we can keep it. So we can seize on his inheritance and keep it for ourselves. That was their motivation. Now, one reason we know that this was the Jews' motivation is because it says, in verse 45, it says, and when the chief priests and Pharisees had heard his parables, they perceived that he spoke of them. They recognized themselves in the parable. They recognized their own motives for wanting to get him out of the way, you see. And so this is clearly their motive. They want to get rid of him because their power is threatened by him coming to claim his kingdom. And so they say, this is the heir. Come, let us kill him and seize on his inheritance. And verse 39 says, and they caught him and cast him out of the vineyard and slew him. Just as the Jews took Jesus outside of Jerusalem and slew him on a hill outside the city walls. When the Lord therefore of the vineyard cometh, what will he do unto those husbandmen? Now the Jews, not thinking right at first exactly what he was talking about, just gave an answer which came natural, which was, of course, one of the few times they gave a just judgment on any subject. Jesus said to them, what do you expect the owner to do in this case? Now, they weren't putting it together at this point. And so they gave an objective answer. And they say unto him, he will miserably destroy those wicked men and will let out the vineyard to other husbandmen, which shall render him the fruits in their seasons. Now, they didn't, essentially what David did when Nathan the prophet came to him, they didn't know they were judging against themselves exactly. Remember when Nathan came and told a parable to David about the guy who stole the one little sheep from his neighbor, even though he had a lot of sheep, and David said, the man shall die. And Nathan said, you're the man, because I gave you all these wives and so forth, and you took this other man's wife for yourself, and he only had one, and you put him to death. And David realized that he'd ruled the death sentence against himself. And that's essentially what the Pharisees were doing here. Jesus told the parable in such a way that they didn't immediately recognize what they were saying. They were just giving a judgment about this parable. Well, what would a guy do if he owned a vineyard? He sent his servants, and they were beaten and killed by the people, by his tenants on his property. And then he sent his son, and they killed him. Wouldn't he go in and take vengeance and wipe them out? Even the Pharisees recognized the justice of that. And so he said, he will go and miserably destroy those wicked men, and will let out his vineyard unto other husbandmen, which will render him fruits in their season. Then in verse 43, we'll skip 42 for the moment. Verse 43, Jesus says, therefore I say to you, the kingdom of God shall be taken from you, and given to a nation bringing forth the fruits thereof. Notice the similarity in the wording of verse 43 that Jesus spoke with the wording of the statement by the Pharisees themselves in verse 41. He'll destroy those who were taking care of it before, and give it to someone else who bring forth the fruits. That's what he says. Okay, I'm going to do that. You're the ones, he's saying. You're the man. The kingdom will be taken from you and given to a nation that will bring forth the fruits thereof. And that nation is the church. Some people have felt that in saying the kingdom shall be taken from you, Jesus simply meant the Pharisees and the scribes. That just the present leaders of Jerusalem would be replaced by better leaders. But that can't be what he means, because he says it will be given to a nation. In other words, a different nation, not just different individuals in leadership, but a totally different nation. Because God had given Israel as a nation one last chance. Now the husbandmen were particularly responsible for not bringing forth the fruit, but the vineyard hadn't brought forth fruit either, and he's finished with the vineyard now. The nation Israel has been reduced to the status of any other nation in God's sight. Because he's taken the kingdom of God from them, and he's given it to a new nation. Now we know what nation that is. What is the fruit? It's spiritual fruit, justice and righteousness he's looking for. Now he said, the nation to whom he gives this vineyard now, or the kingdom, will bring forth the fruits thereof. That's encouraging, because when we look at the church right now, in many respects it doesn't appear to be bringing forth the fruits of justice and righteousness. Yet he predicted they shall. That is the destiny. The church will come to a point where it is, in fact, bringing forth the fruits. In the parable in Isaiah, to which this parable corresponds, in Isaiah's parable of the vineyard, God destroyed the vineyard altogether. In Jesus' parable, he didn't destroy the vineyard, he just turned it over to another group of people. It's as though in Isaiah's time, he didn't turn it over to another nation yet. He destroyed it, and then he resurrected it from the Babylonian captivity. But now he's not going to destroy it and later resurrect it. He's just going to change hands. He's going to take the kingdom from Israel and give it over to a new nation to bear the fruits of it. That nation clearly is the church. You can read in 1 Peter chapter 2. Verses 9 and 10. 1 Peter chapter 2. Verses 9 and 10. Speaking to the Christians, which are the church. But ye are a chosen generation, which actually means an elect race, a royal priesthood, and holy nation. Now, the church is called a holy nation, a peculiar people, that ye should show forth the praises of him who hath called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. We'll stop there. But he says, God has chosen you to bring forth something, to show forth the praises of him. The way we live in justice and righteousness brings forth praise and shows forth the excellency. Actually, the word praise is there in the Greek, means the excellencies in 1 Peter 2, 9. That we should show forth the excellencies of him. So that his character, in other words, not just verbal praises, but his actual character is to be shown forth by us in justice and righteousness. So he sees, Peter sees us as the nation, the holy nation, that will show forth the character of Christ, the character of God. In talking about fruit that the church is to produce, Paul in Galatians 5, the passage you probably know, Galatians 5, verses 21 and 22, I'm sorry, 22 and 23, Galatians 5, 22 and 23, Paul says, but the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faithfulness, meekness, self-control. Against such there is no law. Now this, Paul says, is the fruit of the Spirit. This is the fruit God's looking for. And who produces this fruit? Well, since it's fruit of the Spirit, it can only be produced by those who have the Spirit. And that is the church. The church is anyone upon whom God now has His Spirit. He only gives His Spirit to those who are in Christ. So it's clear that the church has the Spirit of God and is now in the position to be bearing the fruit. And so God has taken the kingdom from Israel. He's taken the vineyard from the husbandman that once had it, and He's given it to another nation, to other husbandmen who will render him his fruits in due season. Now, when we look at the church, we say, hey, 2,000 years the church has been at this and it hasn't brought forth the fruit. Israel had it for about 2,000 years too, by the way. Approximately 2,000 years before Christ, Abraham started the race that he is known for. And so it's kind of interesting. Well, actually, I think 2,000 years would be closer to the Exodus, but the point is that's when the Jewish nation actually got started. So that there was about approximately 2,000 years that God gave to Israel to produce the fruit. They failed, and so He took it from them and gave it to someone else. That someone else is us, the church. But we've been at it for 2,000 years and we haven't produced it yet either. Now the question we might ask ourselves, since He destroyed the vineyard of Israel for not producing fruit, is He also going to destroy the church and start over again? The answer is no. Jesus said, the nation to whom He's given it will produce the fruit. Therefore, the fact that the church is not necessarily in a visible fashion, as much as we think God must wish, showing forth justice and righteousness in the earth, nonetheless, the church will. That's yet in our future. We trust not in much distant future. But in the meantime, instead of rejecting the church and finding another group to do it, God is just waiting for the church to produce the fruit. Hopefully He won't wait much longer. Won't have to. Hope He waits as long as He has to, but hope He won't have to wait much longer. There's in James chapter 5, a verse that has some connection to this. James chapter 5, verses 7 and 8. Be patient, therefore, brethren, unto the coming of the Lord. Behold, the husbandman, in this case God is referred to, waiteth for the precious fruit of the earth, and has long patience for it, until he receive the early and latter rain. Be ye also patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord draweth nigh. Now, he's saying, essentially, that we have to be patient because God is patient. And God is patiently waiting for the fruit of the earth. He hasn't received it yet, but he's waiting patiently. For some reason, he's having more patience with us than with the Jews. But maybe not so much. They had about this long, too. And I certainly hope that he doesn't have to wait much longer. And now we need to go back to Isaiah. So we can see that the parable of the vineyard in Isaiah